House Finance, come to order. It's 2:17 p.m. on the 21st of February 2013. I made up a day where yesterday I called it the 19th, I think. We have members present, Representative Munoz. We have Representative Guttenberg, who is being substituted for by Representative Kawasaki. We have Representative Costello Stoltz, co-chair Osterman, Representative Wilson, Representative Thomas, Representative Holmes, and Vice Chair Newman. Thompson. It's Representative Dave. Representative. Had too much time off there waiting for the meeting. We have a quorum to do business. We have measures before us. We're going to have an abbreviated meeting today. We got late. It started late. I apologize to the members and to the general public. We try to keep on schedule and not have these delays happen until it's later in the session when we just can't avoid them. We're waiting for bills or drafts, but it is what it is. We're just a little late getting started, but we'll plow forward. We have House Bill 35, House Bill 24, and House Bill 75. Well, we'll get through as much of this as we can today. We have to close it down at 3 o'clock. We have some other obligations in the building, so we'll go probably just have presentations. Representative Wilson. T. Wilson.
I don't know why that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and we'll keep it abbreviated. Most of you have heard this bill already last year. For the
we
record,
have a couple of new people, and
yes, and for those, we will be very clear.
Thank
you.
Lots of visitors who didn't hear it last year. Please go ahead.
For the record, my name is Representative Tammy Wilson, District 2. House Bill 35 establishes a low-interest loan program from home heating conversion administered by the Alaska Housing. We have done a good job, I think, in the state in bringing more affordable energy to many different communities here. One of those problems, though, has been how do homeowners now convert whatever they were using for home heating and convert into that new part of that. And just by the communities and organizations that support letters that you'll have in your packets is the City of Fairbanks, the Fairbanks North Star Borough, the City of Wasilla from their mayor, City of Seward, City of Ketchmack, Alaska Aging Commission, Southeast Conference, Alaska State Home Building Association, the Aurora Energy are just a few, and some of them are still going through the process. And for that, we're very thankful for that. But for a brief overview of the loan program, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn it over to my aide, if that's okay.
Please.
For the record, Brandon Bershinsky, staff to Representative Tammy Wilson. House Bill 35 establishes the Home Heating Improvement Loan Program, which will be administered by the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. The loan program will offer low-interest loans for upgrading residential heating systems. The loan program allows for converting from an existing heat source to a more affordable or efficient heating system. An example of that would be from converting from a low-efficiency oil furnace to a higher-efficiency oil furnace, or oil to gas, or biomass to gas. To qualify for a loan, a homeowner must have an inspection of their existing heating system by an energy rater or a mechanical contractor. The energy rater or mechanical contractor will then provide a report to the homeowner determining whether replacing the heating system would increase energy efficiency and provide an estimate of the cost savings. The cost of this inspection can be rolled into the loan. A homeowner is eligible for a loan if the home is owner-occupied and a single-family dwelling or a duplex. Loans under this program will be offered up to a maximum of $15,000 at a 1% interest rate over a 10-year term. Loans will not be subject to income limitations, and the loans will include the cost of the heating appliance, labor, and any materials necessary. So, thank you for your time. We also have representatives from AHFC online for any questions.
Representative Costello.
Thank you. I know that you've been working really hard on addressing some of the high energy costs in the state, in your area and others, and I appreciate this bill. And My question has to do with how is this different than other AHFC programs that exist to help with the same issue? And maybe that's a question for...
Why don't we bring Ms. Schubert up to the table here, and we can have the...
We can answer that question.
Well, and let's and have her, though, answer for the department as well. I'd rather...
That's fine.
That's we always like to go to original source material when we can. Or Ms. Schubert, and if we can't. I'm just joking.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Stacey Schubert. I'm the Director of Government Relations and Public Affairs for Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. We also have folks on the line who can probably answer the question.
We'll allow you to defer to those folks because we want to make sure we're just starting to explore this bill, so let's get questions on the table.
To answer that question, sir, I think the distinguishing factor between this particular bill and the other loan program that we offer that deals with efficiency is that it's a $30,000 loan program, but it's got shorter terms and it has a 3.75% interest rate today, approximately. So the interest rate is higher than what is offered here. And again, Diana Irwin is on the phone and can provide more specifics.
Did you have any follow-up?
No, thank you.
How would this compare with, I know people will have a furnace replacement with the energy efficiency loan, energy efficiency program, the grant, depending on which your eligibility rates. Can you maybe get that on the record as well? And why and how this is different from that, perhaps?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, again, Stacey Schubert, are you referring to the home energy rebate program?
Yes.
That program offers up to $10,000 back for homeowners who choose to participate, but they would receive the rebate after an energy rating is completed, after the completion of all of the upgrades to the home. So that may include a furnace replacement. It might also include insulation, for example, or things of that nature.
But it could include a furnace?
It could include a furnace, yes. It's not likely that the $10,000 would completely cover the cost of the homeowner investment. In fact, most homeowners who participate in the home energy rebate program spend about $6,000 out of their own pocket, and that goes back to the 2008 appropriation and legislative intent where legislators talk to us about those homeowners having skin in the game and
or put another way, get up to $10,000 in grant.
Up to $10,000 back, yes, sir.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. And actually, that's a good point that you're bringing up, is that for some people, it might be a smarter way to do is to go to the rebate program, because although the entire $15,000 might not be given, but maybe $5,000 or $6,000 of that, so even though it's at a higher percentage, it would be a smarter way to go. But it also has to be in your rating that your furnace should be done. So let's say I have a little bit more efficient oil furnace, and I want to go to gas. And the rebate is I'm having it tested. It may not be on the list that would give me that kind of efficiency that it would that if I go over here to this loan because I'm going to a more efficient, affordable. And as you know, in the interior, part of our problem is the air quality. And although a lot of it's from wood smoke, it's also from oil that's a secondary PM 2.5. So we want as many people switching to gas when it's available when we can.
Could you would you be able to combine the two programs if this statute passes with And Ms. Schubert, you or one of your people might know.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, homeowners would be able to participate in both programs as I read this bill.
So you get a grant and a low interest loan.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kawasaki and then Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for presenting this bill. I have a question, though, on the second page on line 2 and then again on line 4, and it talks about increasing the energy efficiency of the home. Are you talking about increasing the efficiency of the heating unit itself?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, yes.
Okay. Because I guess it's not clear. And I guess just to follow up then, nowhere in this bill does it actually say I think the intent was to make sure that folks who have inefficient systems currently that burn inefficiently and burn poorly might be able to find money to upgrade to a better system. That's what's in the sponsor statement?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, it is both, because you can have an efficient oil furnace even in Fairbanks, and if gas comes at a more affordable price than oil, this would allow you to be able to do that. And there are also areas, and I know unlike the area that you come from, that we would not switch to electricity, but there's places where electricity is more affordable than oil. So it's more about the efficiency, and that's what comes with the person who comes in and makes that kind of check. They have to do two things: tell you the efficiency of changing from one source to the other and an approximate amount of savings you hope to do. We're not looking to put people in further debt.
I guess to follow up, Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, as we do it here for the folks that are substituting, we want to make sure you know the rules.
Thanks. The energy efficiency, I guess, put it this way, could a person qualify to put in a very efficient coal-burning unit that's more efficient than the oil-burning unit that they currently have?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, to be able to qualify for HFC, it has to be an automated system. So if it was an automated coal system, it could, through this, but you could not put one that was not automated. And the ones that are automated are the ones that, even through the borough, have passed their air quality standards.
I have another.
Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The in section or in the C, dealing with the whether HFC determines it's available on substantially complete. So if a home's all complete except it doesn't have a heating unit, would that person qualify then, perhaps?
Due to Chair Representative Kawasaki, they wouldn't be upgrading into anything but nothing, so I don't know how you would show the efficiency of not having a furnace at all. So I would believe that I have confidence in Alaska Housing Finance that it would not qualify.
Okay, and just a policy question, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Kawasaki.
It's dealing with the income limitations. Have you thought about allowing some sort of a system? I know HFC has a lot of tiered systems to allow for homeowners and renters that are that just don't make enough money, maybe seniors, those types of things. Have you considered that as a policy call?
Through Chair Representative Kawasaki, there's interior weatherization that actually goes to exactly what you're talking about, and they have replaced other people's furnaces for free. This doesn't have an income level because this is really about using those new sources of energy that some have come from state funding, some from private funding, and allowing the homeowners to take advantage of that. And to me, it shouldn't matter how much money you make. It's more trying to, and especially this was a Fairbanks bill to start with, making sure we had those tools in the toolbox. And because of wonderful work that was done through committees, it's become a statewide issue because some have wind, some have solar, some have, you know, hydro. And at this point, we are trying to help Alaskans to come up with a more efficient, cost-wise and actually for us, air quality. And that's what this was geared for. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question's answered.
Representative Thompson, did you?
I'm fine.
Okay. Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Wilson, I don't see any major problems with the bill other than I'm not sure about the cost, but I understand the problems in your area, and I'm happy that you made it a statewide bill because in pockets around the state there are big problems also, so I appreciate it. Mr. Chair,
Representative Guerra.
I'm just going to have to jump in and out of this committee meeting, but I'll be back. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Wilson. And I appreciate the work that you've made to expand the program to not just include the interior areas, but statewide. My question is on the capitalization of the fund. How much money do you anticipate it will require to get this fund going? From the perspective of AHFC?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, as much as you want to give us, you know, but I think that's a question. Alaska Housing has done this more, and they have a few figures on, you know, if it's set at a certain amount, how many homes that would take care of.
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, this is Stacey Schubert again from Alaska Housing Finance Corporation for the record. We do not have a good sense of how many homes may be interested in participating in this program, and that is why we submitted an indeterminate fiscal note. Recognizing that at $15,000 per loan, truly it's the intent of the legislature and with a general fund appropriation to allow AHFC to move this program forward and out to the public.
1% is the interest rate on the loan. Is that sufficient to cover your costs for administering the program?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, In the indeterminate fiscal note, AHFC is estimating at this point a 10% administration fee. The way that the loan would work is that we would partner with local financial institutions like an Alaska USA or Wells Fargo or something like that, so that homeowners could go out to those institutions and request this loan through them. As a result, we do believe that 10% would allow us to cover our costs.
10% of the loan or 10% of the fund?
10% through the chair, Representative Munoz, 10% of the fund.
Of the appropriation?
That's correct, yes.
Any follow-up, Representative Munoz?
That was all. Thank you.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Two quick questions. First, so the bill as written would require somebody to go out, the homeowner, to get the inspection done, and it would require the inspector to report back on these three items, but there's no actual requirement as to what those findings are to qualify for the loan. In other words, even if the inspector came back and said there are no cost savings and it's not more efficient, the way I read this, I would think a homeowner wouldn't do that because that wouldn't make any sense, but there's no actual, the way I read this, we want them to get the inspection so the homeowner will have the information to make the decision, but then it's up to the homeowner whether they proceed regardless of what the findings are.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holmes, that is correct, but also something that can also be dealt with in regulations like Alaska Housing has done with other programs.
And Mr. Chairman, if I may, so going to Stacy, since she's sitting there, do you read it that you would have the ability to write regulations that would require certain types of findings under this language?
Through the chair, Representative Holmes, the Home Energy Rebate Program does have those thresholds in place where there are certain efficiency requirements that that are required in order to get the maximum rebate back. As we read this bill, we would not foresee including regulations that created a requirement unless this body created an amendment. We really believe that this will provide us the direction to move forward in whatever way you see fit.
Okay, so it's, Mr. Chairman, I'm not weighing in. This is up to the sponsors and the committee, I guess, as to where you want to go with it. But the way I read it right now, regardless of what the findings are, you could still get the loan. And it may be that we're just going to trust homeowners that they're not going to go forward with a project that isn't going to save them money and become more efficient. But
Mr. Representative Holmes, you know, this is a loan, so I can't imagine that someone would want to go and show no efficiencies, no savings, and put themselves more into debt, especially when we're talking about areas that are already being hit pretty hard with energy costs. And we had talked about how far down kind of into the weeds that we'd want to go and require those. And since it's a loan versus a grant, and I think one reason the rebate program does that because it is a grant and they want to be able to go back with those savings, I think at this point we think Alaskans are very smart and will do what they believe they need to. I appreciate that.
Thank you. And Mr. Chairman, if I may ask one more question. On a totally different note, on page 2, line 19, it says that the loan will be shall be repaid over a term of 10 years. And I guess this is probably a question more for Stacy. Does that allow prepayment? And if so, without the interest?
Through the chair, Representative Holmes, as I understand it, all of the loans that AHFC offers currently do allow for prepayment without penalty, and we would implement this program in the same manner.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just one more question, because in your original statement you talked about gas, natural gas coming to Fairbanks, and I guess I'm looking at Section C and then one of the exclusions where it would not be eligible is number two, the energy source fueling or powering the improved or replaced heating systems not available. So that means that since I can't get natural gas in my house, that would mean I can't get a natural gas boiler put in?
Through Chair Representative House, if you have gas coming to your house, why would you want to put a gas?
Well,
I'm sorry, I shouldn't ask a question. I'm sorry, I shouldn't ask a question.
No, could you do a propane conversion and anticipating gas?
Sure.
Or lots of options. Representative Kawasaki, I didn't mean to.
No, that's the question. I guess that's the. I mean, sorry.
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki.
I think we were heading the same direction.
Yeah, and at this point, I'm not sure whether we got, and I'm not trying to pass the buck to anybody at Alaska Housing. We will get back to you on that answer on that. I think some of this language actually came from the way that the rebate program currently is, but I'm not positive, so we will get to you with that answer.
you know, to me.
Please, go ahead.
Just, and, you know, just kind of the idea is that there's natural gas that stops at one road, and then the other neighbors just didn't want it. But there's an idea that if we could build sort of a demand side, that maybe more and more of those neighbors down the road would want it, and then the line would go all the way through. And I guess the idea is that if this, I mean, if the bill, natural gas is going to be the key to the future, I think, for Fairbanks, and I think that we can anticipate changes here. But this would specifically mean that I couldn't upgrade, even though I knew gas was coming.
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, and, you know, and since this isn't funded, and we know there's a big need once it does, you know, for me to have this portion in there, I would hope that the first people who would be able to do that would be those who have the sources available. I understand what you're saying, and it would be nice if people are proactive in being able to put a unit in anticipation that they will do that. But I think right now there's a big demand in the state for affordable energy already there, and Fairbanks is not there at this portion at this point, but there are other communities that are ready to that, you know, and I will again check into it, but I think keeping it more narrowed down to those who truly need it at this point and have those sources available, but we'll get it clarified. I'll get it clarified for you and the committee as well. I'll go through the co-chair for that.
I have a question, I guess, for Ms. Schubert. How does that 10% get fit into the portfolio, or at the how is that absorbed? Does that become a closing cost, or do you need a separate appropriation to pay for the program? I guess I'm unclear on that. When you say there would be a 10% cost of does that become part, but it doesn't become part of the loan? That's a big hanging question. Is that going to be put on the consumer to pay for the 10%? I guess those are policy questions we have to determine, but how would you imagine that might work out?
Mr. Chairman, for the record again, Stacey Schubert, and on page 3 of the bill, lines 1 and 2, it talks about the interest paid on loans shall be deposited into the general fund. So recognize that this isn't totally a revolving loan program, and as a result, not knowing how big you would want the loan to be, we wanted to provide you with the information that we felt or a percentage that we felt would be reasonable for the program if the size of the fund, for example, or the program were $5 million. That's one thing. If it's $50 million, that's another thing. And so we feel that 10% would have to come from the original appropriation to cover those costs and to cover marketing to the Alaskans, to let them know that this program does exist, and in partnership with the financial institutions that we work with. But we would not see it exceeding that amount. We would certainly hope for something smaller than that, but did want to come forward with a reasonable number that we felt comfortable with.
Yeah, I didn't see how it could even come close to revolving with only a 1% interest rate, and certainly not with a 10% rake or scrape. But unless we're going to have some less conventional loan agents that usually not under state law. Any other questions? I think you've heard some of the questions, Representative Wilson, and I think you know some of the missionary work you have to do to answer some of the questions. We'll try to get this back before us again. I wanted to bring this issue out. It's energy issue that's important to any area of the state, especially I'm not tone deaf. I know I hear some of the things from the interior. I can count on this committee of the interest, so we will revisit this issue. Representative Wilson.
I could just add one thing for the record, Representative Wilson. There was a question by Representative Edgman. I just wanted to get on the record that he had asked, would someone have to get rid of their system that they're upgrading? And we know in some communities, especially the Bush communities, getting parts for broken systems is very hard to do. You do not have to get rid of your system. You could use it for a backup, but this one would have to be your primary. And so recognizing that some areas have more issues with getting things into a community, we want to make sure that we keep things as safe in those communities as we can. And I had just remembered that we were going to touch that. I appreciate your time, and we will get back to you.
I guess one takeaway question is, would you be allowed to keep an old system if you were in an area there might be a real benefit to have a redundant system? Could you, under this proposed statute, could you keep a redundant system in place and add another system?
Through Chair, or Mr. Chair, absolutely. But this has to be your primary source. That's where it makes a difference. Many of us, especially even in Fairbanks, do have two systems.
I always remember the story of Jay Hammond when President Carter said we needed to set our thermoses at 68 degrees, or said he was going to meet that mandate even if he had to add a second furnace. With that, we'll set aside this bill, and we look forward to revisiting it again later. Thank you, Ms. Schubert, Ms. Brzezinski, Mr. Brzezinski, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, sir.
Representative Newman, do you want to present from your chair or from the table? What's your preference?
Right here is fine, Mr. Chair.
Okay. We have our next item up is House Bill 24. And as we had announced prior, we were trying to get out of here by 3 o'clock. We have some other actions going on in the building. So as it's been well announced, this is just the initial presentation of the bill to present it, and there'll be public testimony later on, with including into the evening. So I think we've announced that pretty clearly on our schedules. So you want us to open or just defer to Mr. Shattuck?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to take a minute before I turn it over to staff to walk through this bill, but also thank many of the Alaskans who sent the emails and called my offices on this. And you know, I think we've all received probably 25 or 30 a day, it seems like, that are coming in on this, so I appreciate that. I filed House Bill 24 simply to clarify that an individual's rights exist not only in our home with our castle doctrine, but also, you know, added the words, in any other place that we have a right to be. House Bill 24 does that by simply adding that language to Alaska statute in a new section which states, in any other place where a person has a right to be. Mr. Speaker, or Mr. Chair, in a stressful situations, Alaskans want to know that they can defend themselves and not have to worry about how the courts will see their actions. You know, and this is an important issue that we look at and how it's done, and there's two parts to this bill, too, and I think staff will go through that. Mr. Chair, again, I'd like to have staff maybe walk it through the bill, but I do have one other person online to help present this bill.
Okay. And well, are they, who is it online?
I believe we have Mr. Brian Judy from the National Rifle Association.
He's done the presentation of the bill. Okay. Right. All right. We will, we'll start with Mr. Shattuck, and then we'll go on to a brief presentation by the other gentleman.
For the record, my name is Rex Shattuck, staff to the sponsor, Representative Mark Newman. Like Representative Newman, I'd like to thank the co-chairs of House Finance and for hearing this, scheduling this piece of legislation, and for the other members so taking their time to listen to why we believe it's time to clarify the changes that are proposed in HB 24. I'd also like to thank the sponsor for allowing me to work on this bill. It's near to my heart, and he and I have spent a lot of hours working on it. Alaska statutes already recognize that we have a right to use deadly force to protect our family, person, and property. HB 24 further clarifies that right exists not only in our homes, but in any place we have a right to be. This legislation has been before the House before the House Finance Committee before, and I'd like to report that there's still the strength of support that it had, and we continue to hear from people. As the sponsor said, you probably have a bunch of contacts in your packet. Turning to the bill, HB 24 amends AS 1181-335, Section B, by adding a new subsection seen on page 2 of the bill, line 3. That subsection is 5, and it states, in any other place where the person has a right to be. The original version was amended in the previous committee by inserting the word other between in any and place where person has to be, as seen on page 2, line 3. By adding this brief subsection, we further clarify what is already in Alaska statutes. The first paragraph in 1181-355 Section B, as seen on page 1, line 4 of the bill, shows that we recognize that there's a sanctity of life, and that's done by line 4, page 1, a person may not use deadly force under this section if the person knows that with complete personal safety and without complete safety to others being defended, the person can avoid the necessity of using deadly force by leaving the area of the encounter, except there is no duty to leave the area if the person is on their premise, that the person owns, that the person actually owns or leases, where the person resides temporarily or permanently, or in C, as a guest or express or implied agent of the owner, lease, or resident. We also recognize in that statute under 2 and 3 that a peace officer acting within the scope of his authority and a person in a building where they have a right, where they're working, has that same right. 4 on line 2 of page 5 addresses protecting a child or a member of the person's household. And so what we add is 5 in any other place where a person has a right to be. I'd like to quote the sponsor and what he said, and it basically boils down to this. It's my intention that a person who meets the legal framework for justification to use deadly force in the defense in self-defense has no duty to retreat from any place where the person has a legal is legally present. The statutes also say that we don't have to retreat, as I just covered. The important thing to understand about this legislation is that we don't change the fact that a person must be justified in using deadly force, as well as being in your home or in a place that that you have a legal right to be. There's some a couple things I think are worth pointing out. In federal law, stand your ground or no duty to retreat already governs U.S. federal cases, case law, in which self-defense is asserted against the charge of a criminal homicide. The Supreme Court ruled in Beard versus U.S. in 1895 that a man who was, quote, where he had the right to be, close quote, when he came under attack and, quote, did not provoke the assault and had the time, reasonable grounds to believe and in good faith believe that the deceased intended to take his life or do him great body harm, was not obligated to retreat nor to consider where he could safely retreat to, but was entitled to stand his ground. Another case of on this is a Minnesota case, State versus Gardner, where a man was acquitted for killing another man who attempted to kill him with a rifle. The judge commented in the case, he said that the doctrine of retreat to the wall or duty to retreat had its origin in the medieval England before the general introduction of guns. He said that justice demands its application have due regard to the general use and type of weapons. So basically this concept of the castle doctrine and duty to retreat or retreat to the wall are from some time back in and it was Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes who declared in Brown versus the United States that when upholding the no duty to retreat maxim, detached reflection cannot be demanded in the presence of an uplifted knife. In closing, I suppose one could go into the justifications, deadly force, non-deadly force, and I'd be happy to sort of just sit here and pass it over to questions from the committee and the other witness that we have with us.
Just we're going to go to we have somebody on line, but Representative Thompson, you have a quick question.
I just had I have a couple of questions, but I'll start with how many other states have similar laws to this?
I would defer a more accurate count, perhaps Mr. Brian Judy, but at last count I understood there were 17 plus.
And then a follow-up question is different. Would this bill enable a person to use deadly force to protect a victim of a crime? If I saw somebody ready to shoot somebody else or ready to hit them with a baseball bat that would kill them, would this fit into that situation?
Statutes already make provisions for
that. And the conversation is not with Mr. Representative Thompson.
Through the chair, Representative Thompson, the statutes already make provisions for that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Let's go to the testimony so we don't miss that. We'll come to questions right after that. Mr. Judy, are you still online?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chairman.
You have go ahead and identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony, sir.
Okay, Mr. Chairman.
Well, it's not testimony. I guess aid in presenting the bill. We haven't opened up.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Brian Judy. I'm the Alaska State Liaison for the National Rifle Association. And can I, just for clarification, I know you said that you're going to try to get out of here, and according to my...
Well, why don't you go ahead and take the time you need, and we're trying to shoot it closer to three, but we'll get through your part of the testimony or presentation.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 24 is important self-defense legislation, and it would provide that a law-abiding person who is justified in using deadly force in self-defense has no duty to retreat from an attack from any place a person has a legal right to be. And I want to just reiterate that the person has to be justified. A lot of the opposition to this bill just doesn't understand that, or they ignore that. Existing Alaska law already provides that there is no duty to retreat if a person who is justified is on premises on which the person owns or leases, where they reside, in a building where they work. In any other place, however, if a person knows that he or she can safely retreat from an encounter, the person is legally required to do so. So in an encounter that necessitates an individual to use deadly force in self-defense, there are two considerations the person must take into account under the existing law, and this won't change that. The primary and most significant consideration is justification. And the second and much less significant consideration is retreat. The only time retreat even becomes a consideration is once a person has made the determination that she's justified in using deadly force in self-defense. Now, existing law, and let me point out that the way legislation is drafted in Alaska, you're all aware of this, it only amends what you see in print in the bill is just the very narrow bit of law that's being amended. In this case, it's that subsection B of 1181.335. However, you have to look at subsection A of that section, and in fact, you also have to go back to 1181.330. And if you look at all the statutes in their entirety, you will find a very detailed, very specific, well-thought-out, documented legal framework for what constitutes justification in the Alaska statutes. And I feel it's critical to review that so the committee will have an idea of what the existing law requires for a person to claim justification, which, again, comes into play before the issue of retreat even is considered. So to be justified under the Alaska statutes, a person may use deadly force in self-defense only if the person reasonably believes the use of deadly force is necessary for self-defense against five things: death, serious physical injury, kidnapping, sexual assault, or robbery. Only against those potential life-threatening crimes is deadly force justified. And I have to note that to employ self-defense, a person must satisfy, under Alaska case law, both a subjective and an objective standard. In other words, the person must actually believe deadly force is necessary to protect him or herself, and that belief must be one that a reasonable person would have held under the circumstances. Now, in addition to all that, there's laid out actually in 1181.330 a list of activities that specifically preclude a person from claiming justification, either in using deadly force or non-deadly force. If the person is engaged in mutual combat, if the person provoked the other's conduct, if the person was the initial aggressor, or if the person was involved in felonious activity or gang activity, the person is specifically precluded from claiming justification. And I want to point out at this point that you're probably going to hear, in previous committees we've heard, and I'm sure you're going to hear, a lot of scenarios in which the person describing the scenario is going to suggest that the world is going to stop turning because of this law, this proposed law, and it's going to allow people in all these just ridiculous scenarios you very well may hear about. It's going to allow a person to inappropriately use self-defense. And it's just not the case. I think you will be able to find in every scenario that you will hear, that you may hear, there's going to be one of these components, either mutual combat, a provocation, an initial aggressor circumstance, or some kind of felonious or gang activity. So if you hear these, I want you to think very critically about what actions are actually taking place in these cases and how they would specifically not allow a person to claim justification in the circumstances, which means that they don't even get to the issue of retreat. So again, just to summarize, a person using deadly force in self-defense must have justification and must consider that question, the question of justification, in the split second he or she has to decide whether to respond to an aggressor with force. So if you remove the additional question as to whether or not the person can retreat with complete safety, that's going to provide one less thing that a potential victim must concern himself or herself with in that life or death split-second decision-making process. And that's what it comes down to. When a person is fearing for their life, they first have to go through this very complicated legal framework. Now, obviously, they're not going to be able to do it. They have to, I mean, it's going to be a split-second decision. You know, am I justified? And if they use deadly force, they're probably going to have to end up hiring an attorney and making the case that they were justified. So we don't believe that in that split second, they have to make that determination based on that arduous legal framework of justification. And then if they determine that they are justified, now they have to bring into the equation a whole second question: can I retreat with complete safety? So the some opponents may say that, well, a person's only required to retreat if he or she knows that they can do so with complete safety. And yes, that is true. However, like I just said, a person who meets the arduous legal requirement for justification because her life is at immediate risk should not have to concern herself with that additional question of retreat. Basically, under existing law, a person who resists an aggressor bears the risk of a finding that although their response, in self-defense, was proportional to the reasonably perceived threat, in other words, it was justified because their life was at imminent risk of death or serious bodily injury, despite all that, if the person overestimated the difficulty of getting away unscathed, they could still be guilty of a crime despite being justified. And the NRA believes that is just not right. Removing the retreat provision shifts some of the risk calculation back to the aggressor. I want to make one more point, and then I'll let you move on for any questions. And this is, you know, maybe in the context of this committee, the most pertinent point. Many have suggested that this bill will increase the cost of criminal prosecution. And the NRA believes that's absolutely false. In fact, House Bill 24 should save money because, again, this bill in no way changes the primary requirement that a person using deadly force in self-defense must have justification, and it in no way changes what constitutes justification. So under the provisions of this bill, once the prosecution has determined that there was justification, charges should be dropped, and their job is done. Prosecutors will not have to spend additional resources to evaluate that second question, the question of retreat. With that, I would be happy to answer any questions.
We have a limited time. Did you have any amplification of that testimony, Representative Newman?
Mr. Chair, I think that Mr. Judy pretty much covered a lot of the issues that Gate asked. And again, I'd just like to present, we've been through a lot of what-ifs, and they are covered in prior sections, in particularly in Section A, which is a justification section. You know, if somebody's a mutual combat, if they're drinking, if they're an aggressor, and if they're in robbery, any of their physical serious injury. This just says that the rights you have, that when you're in your home or where you work You should have them when you walk down the street. You should have them when you're in a legal place where you want to be, and that's what we're trying to promote here, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
We're going to be closing out today, but I'll invite the folks. Thank you to the folks from Public Safety for being here. We want you to have you up before the panel and the portion of the next hearing before we take up public testimony, so you can put any comments on the record and be available for questions as for your role in the administration of justice chain, as well as folks from the Department of Law Criminal Division. They will be here next meeting, as they are on any bill with these impacts. So we'll have those folks before us, as well as we're going to see if how much public testimony we can take. We're deferring to it. There's been so much, such a volume. This is only a fraction of what I've gotten. This is just the last day or two, not counting phone calls. Want to make sure I deferred to have an evening testimony, because most of these people seem like they're folks that worked. I was just making that assessment because they kind of represent a lot of the values I was familiar with, so I assume they had jobs or were retired anyway. So we opted for an evening meeting, and we may extend on depending on the volume of testimony, but we'll see how the first evening section goes. With that, we will, the bills that we set aside, this one and the one we don't get to today, 75, will all be before us on bills previously heard, but we have noticed the specific time for House Bill 24 because of the level of public interest. So we wanted to let folks know when that was occurring, so folks on all sides would be aware of this. It's the process would allow us just to have it on the bills previously heard. It's always our intent to let people know what bills are coming up. So with that, we will stand in adjournment.